Il-program li ser tisimaw u għamiġjub li l-kombixu għatajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the program that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. Delighted to have with me in the studio today on University Matters, Martin Ward, who is coordinator mental health nursing programs of the Faculty of Health Sciences here at the university. Just a few words about my guest. He has over 35 years of experience in psychiatric nursing as a practitioner, lecturer, educational manager, researcher, politician and writer, and has lectured all over the world. Till 2000, he was director of mental health for the Royal College of Nursing in the UK and still works as an independent nursing consultant on projects for the EU Commission and European organisations. He is author or editor of 8 books on mental health care and has over 80 published papers on the subject and is an associate editor of an international nursing journal. He is special board member of HORATIO, European Psychiatric Nurses, based in Holland, and chair of the European Expert Panel of Psychiatric Nursing. He has a specific interest in the development of both professional and personal skills and how these interact within an organisational structure. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Patricia.
Perhaps we'd better start off by looking in a general sense at mental health in society, what we mean by a mental health challenge within our society, what is involved really.
I think one of the great problems that modern society faces is its health problems, and specifically mental health, because over the years, from probably the beginning of the 20th century onwards, we've recognized just the enormous impact that good mental health has on your ability to lead a normal, independent, happy and joyous life. And increasingly research tells us that more and more people are developing mental health problems. Now, whether this is a disease of the 21st century, I don't know, but it certainly would appear that the stresses of life, the difficulties that people face, are having an impact on their ability to be happy and to be able to function as a somebody who runs their own life. And I suppose the biggest example of that is the condition of depression. There are different forms of depression, and so I'm using this as a cover-all, but the most recent figures from 2011 show that 9% of all the EU male and female adult working age adults at any one time are suffering from some form of depression. That's 20 million people. And if you look at the cost of that, a conservative estimate, and it is conservative because there's a lot of underreporting, is that that's costing the EU 113 billion euros a year.
Yes, and it's difficult to think of things in a subject like that in terms of finance, but of course, yes, it is, and it must be an enormous drain on resources that perhaps could be improved.
Yes, and I suppose to put that into context, it means that depression has been identified as probably by 2020, the WHO think that it will be the world's second largest health burden. So we're talking about something increasing rather than reducing.
What would the expenses be taking an individual? Why does it add up to so much?
Well, it's about lost days at work. It's about the cost of supporting somebody, especially in the community. I mean, there are, as I said, there are different types of depression and there are different classifications. And just because you're depressed doesn't mean to say you're in hospital. So that's only the extreme cases would finish up requiring mental health services. But say in here in Malta, for example, you have to go to your GP, you have to pay for your medication, you may have to take time off work. So there's expenses all round. And then there's the human cost to your relatives, to your partner, to your wife, your husband, your children. And, you know, I suppose the most extreme consequence of depression is suicide. And on average, we have between 20 and 30 suicides in Malta a year, which puts us very low down the European table, but it's still 20 or 30 suicides. It's estimated that on average, 16 people are affected directly by a person's suicide. So, you know, we're talking large sums of both emotional and financial cost for a condition which is still stigmatized and still regarded as something that somehow a person can just shake off.
Of course, there are other conditions. We hear a lot about addictions and various types of addiction as
well. Yes, yes. I mean, the classic one, of course, is everyone automatically assumes we're talking about recreational drugs, but and that is a major problem, and in particular amongst the youth of Europe, and also it's a major issue here in Malta as well. But it's alcohol, and alcohol is more, in a sense, is more of a problem because it's more accepted that people drink alcohol. It's not accepted that you don't go to a dinner party and get handed cocaine unless you happen to live in Hollywood. But here in Malta, it's not acceptable, but it is acceptable to offer somebody immediately a drink, and some people just can't handle it. But it's not just drugs and alcohol, it's gambling, it's all sorts of things.
Computer addiction,
yes.
In the press about that.
Yes, and one school of thought suggests that that's one of the reasons why we have such an obese youth within Europe generally, and specifically in Malta, where we have a high fascination with IT, and young people are very, very IT literate here.
What about the question of longevity? We've spoken now about young people sitting in front of a computer for a long time. They might not be addicted, but they, you know, there is that possibility. But probably longevity has meant that people have more time to develop more problems.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and of course, I suppose the major one is the major one that we automatically go to is the problem of dementia. I'm a board member of the Malta Dementia Society, and our figures suggest that up to 4,000 people in Malta are actively suffering from dementia. And this affects, and it's irreversible degenerative disorder, which gets worse and never gets better. And the burden of caring for that on partners and family is enormous. But one also has to remember that it's not just, in old age, it's not just dementia that's a problem. The three sets of people who are most likely to commit suicide are young people, and in particular young males, and the elderly. The over 70s, and with a small group of individuals in between. But those two, the two ends of the sort of life continuum, and are the most at risk. And we tend to forget that amongst old people whose friends have died. They've lost a sense of who they are. They've no longer got a job. They don't feel that they're worth anything. And it's very difficult to get at them because they tend to suffer in silence.
Here in Malta, we tend to have an extended family group to help out. But increasingly, more people are working in the family and therefore perhaps not able to look after elderly parents as perhaps they were looked after in the past. I don't know if that's an anecdotal, of course, not an academic research.
I think that the research does show is that in countries like Italy, Malta, Ireland, where there are strong family values and where families do tend to support each other, that the health burden is quite considerable, especially during this economic climate where people have to perhaps take second jobs to make ends meet.
What about the answers to this challenge of mental health in society? How are we going to cope with this now and moving into the future?
If you take the most conservative estimate that 10% of the population at any one time have a mental health problem, that means that we're talking nearly 40,000 people in Malta, most of whom will go, if they seek help, will go to a general practitioner. and will receive help there, although the evidence does show that 50% of people who go to a general practitioner with a mental health problem are misdiagnosed, and of the remaining 50%, 50% of those, so 25% only, get the most appropriate care and the most appropriate support. So it's a bit of a it's a bit hit and miss at times as to whether or not your GP is sympathetic to your problems. However, that aside, 40,000 people requiring some kind of help, whether it be from family or friends at that level or hospital admission at another level, is a major health problem. And so, as I say, it's not simply a question of everybody of those 40,000 needing specialist care. But at the tip of the iceberg, of those people who are severely ill, severely mentally ill, with things like depression, anxiety, eating disorders, drug disorders, and, of course, the major chronic illness, which tends to be the psychotic, the schizophrenic, the bipolar disorders, and so on. Those have got to be, at some point or other, will require some form of hospital admission. And so the first thing that that a country has to do, not just Malta, but any country, is make sure there's an infrastructure to support its most severely ill. And that works its way down through the system in terms of training and education and support for everybody in that chain, including the GPs, including the community workers, social services. But essentially, you have to provide the personnel for staffing a base hospital, if that's what you're going to have, if that's the model you choose to use, and that is the model that we have in Malta.
The nursing that's going to be needed for these people who are coming into the hospital, the base hospital, or, yes, or the outreach,
yes,
would be specialist nurses.
It depends very much on the terminology you use, but psychiatric and mental health nurses are a specialist form of nursing. And in Malta, we're lucky that we have, as part of our legal registration system, the opportunity to have nurses who only specialise in psychiatry and in mental health. But since 2004, we've had degree programmes in psychiatric nursing, specifically for people working at Mount Carmel Hospital and SVPR with the psychogeriatric population, and in the community and in the mental health services. Converting general nurses to psychiatric, it's a part-time program, and that's been highly successful. But as of 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we opened a direct entry 3-year undergraduate program. And small numbers, which is what we like to teach. It's a very difficult, it's an intensive course, and you can't really teach to large numbers. And small numbers, but our first group will graduate this year, and all the feedback we're getting from their clinical placements and their mentors and clinical supervisors is that these are an extraordinarily talented group of individuals, mostly young, although we do have one or two mature students in there, and a hugely satisfying group to teach.
Quite a difficult decision to choose a specialist course like that when you're a young person.
Yes.
I can understand the conversion course being a bit of an easier decision to be made, because the nurses will have already had experience in a hospital environment,
yes,
and therefore they'll know their strengths and their weaknesses, and then it is with that experience behind them that they would make the decision to make the conversion course. An 18-year-old has to perhaps have certain personal skills. It's not perhaps a course for everybody.
No, it's definitely not a course for everybody. And in fact, I'm still amazed after all these years that people actually want to go ahead and do it in the same way that I did when I was also 18. But I, you know, having spent 30 odd years in the profession, I've never regretted for one minute that that was what I chose to do. I could have made lots of money in other ways, but money is not the reason for going into psychiatric nursing. But I chose to do it myself, and when I look at the young people that I see on the undergraduate program, they are very similar in they're all different people, they've all got their individual characteristics, but they are similar in many ways. And I suspect that if they'd never signed up to be a specialist nurse, they would have still had nursing at heart, no matter what they did. They tend to be optimistic, generally optimistic. They believe that they can actually make a difference. They tend to be quite confident. They tend to be articulate. They tend to show that sense of caring, which sometimes is missing in society. They think about each other. And so as a consequence, these small groups very soon become very tight-knit, very self-supporting, and they look out for each other in quite an incredible way. But I think also, I think the optimism is one of the key issues, because, you know, the glass being half full or half empty is a major issue in healthcare. If you believe you can make a difference, then chances are you will. If you believe you can't, then chances are you should be doing something else. But of course, that's perhaps a massive generalization. But optimism, I think, and a belief in your abilities is really important.
I think it will be important to be getting that message out to the potential students,
yes, yes,
who would perhaps recognise in themselves at least sort of that basic requirement,
yes,
so that it would help them to even consider,
yes,
doing a course like this.
And I think the other thing is that they have to have a general inquisitiveness about other people. They have to like listening to other people talk, because you're all the time analysing their conversation, you're assessing their mental health status, you are trying to work out how to use the skills that we teach on the course to intervene in this person's life in such a way that they are going to improve and recover. And so I think also it's about being a people person. And I have to say, having a sense of humour, because sometimes that's the only thing that sees you through.
I'm quite sure. The course that we offer here that you've mentioned, which is the degree course, clearly the students would need the skills, the personal skills that you've just been mentioning, but there are also special course requirements,
yes,
for it, because it is it's a BSc.
Yes.
BSc. So what are those?
We have two entry requirements, one for undergraduates or for young people that have just left formal education. So they need their matriculation certificate and secondary education certificate passes at grade 5 or better in Maltese, English language and mathematics, and they also need a pass at A level in biology. Now, if you happen to be over the age of 23 on the 1st of October of that year that you apply, you can also get in under the maturity clause, so you don't need to have educational qualifications, but you will need to be interviewed. That's quite useful, because I think we've got examples on courses at the moment of people who've had families, or they've gone in one direction with a career and they've realised that perhaps they want to do something a bit special with their lives and they want to make a change, and we offer that opportunity. And I think that the groups we have often, the mixture of youngsters and more mature students from anything from 23 up to 45, is a nice collection of individuals, because it's not everybody at the same age group, and they can offer each other different experiences and support.
I can imagine that would be definitely value added, to have that age group mix. When they actually come in and do the course, what do you offer?
The course itself is very much designed around European requirements. So to do an undergraduate program in the faculty, you need to gather 180 European credit transfer units, points. And so each year is divided into 60. And that calculates out to about 4,500 hours, of which approximately half is practical and half is theoretical. So students spend a period of time in classroom, and in the first it's six semesters, obviously it's a three-year program. And in the first semester they only do theory, and then they have five semesters of clinical placements, of which they do altogether eight. And those eight placements are in child and adolescents, adult, elderly, long stay, hospital, secure, forensic, dual diagnosis for drugs and so on. So it's and community, obviously. So it's very a very wide-ranging set of placements, and during which they're always mentored and have a clinical supervisor, and they have to complete a competence portfolio through their 3 years. And the theoretical side of it is really the balance that gives them the underpinning for the work that they do. So we concentrate a lot on interpersonal communication skills, psychology. We obviously have to teach the psychiatry. They need to understand the conditions, the symptoms, the side effects of the medication. So we also need to teach psychopharmacology. And human skills, human behavior skills, understanding of the anatomy of the brain and how that works and so on. But we also focus on personal skills or personal technology. So we do a lot of role play, a lot of camera work, which always causes hilarity when you feedback their interpersonal activities. But that's quite useful as well, because what we do is we show them at the end of their 3 years what they did in the first year, and compare the two to look at, to see how they've evolved, how they've developed. And, you know, considering that some of them were 18 when they started and now 21, 22 when they finish.
Big difference, yes.
We spend a lot of time looking at interpersonal skills, but also the nursing that goes with it. So dealing with psychiatric emergencies, how to deal with different approaches, how to deal with different conditions. It's quite an intensive course.
Sounds like it.
At the end of it, an individual is pretty much able to deal with most of the standard situations that they might be confronted with in a psychiatric.
And there are many different areas that they could be working in then when they graduate. You mentioned that the course offers opportunities to touch on the various areas where, and they might discover during the course that they have a particular penchant for a particular area, I suppose.
Yes.
And maybe try and find a job afterwards in that area.
Yes. I mean, we're lucky in a sense that Malta offers a variety of employment opportunities within the mental health service and mental health services. So all of those placements I just mentioned, at some point or other, there's a possibility that they could be employed in them. And, you know, some people prefer to work in the community, which is hugely challenging and very risky at times. Or others prefer to work with the elderly. So there's quite a lot of, and in between those two, there's a whole gamut of things. And what's great about Malta is that a lot of the new services that have been developed, in particular the outreach and the dual diagnosis, and a lot of the other specialist areas, are led by graduates in psychiatric nursing, and without them, they probably wouldn't be able to have developed those services. And so, to a certain degree, it's quite an achievement on the part of a relatively small group of people that they're feeding back such a service to the community. In fact, Mount Carmel Hospital, in July, will have more qualified psychiatric nurses on staff than those who do not have a psychiatric qualification. And in 2004, there weren't any, apart from a few that had a diploma. So we've really turned things around a bit.
I'd like to talk a little bit about you, because, first of all, you obviously had a very interesting ITER, and I think it's important also to note that people can do different things with the qualifications they get.
Yes.
In your case, you've done a lot more, really, than be a psychiatric nurse in a clinical situation.
I was in the Royal Army Medical Corps in the UK, which is the military, and I went to their college at the age of 16 because I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And one of the guys that was there as one of our trainers was a qualified psychiatric nurse, and I'd always admired this man for, you know, the way he dealt with problems. He was always very cool, laid back, nothing seemed to ruffle him. And one day when I was getting near the decision-making process, I asked him what his background was, and he told me. So it really sort of came from purely by accident that I thought about going into psychiatric nursing, and I went down and had a look at the military hospital where they were trained. I was interviewed, I got the job, and I got on the course. And within a very short space of time, I realized how lucky I was that I'd chosen something that I actually wanted to do. It was, I have to say, fraught with various disasters over the first few months. But I managed to come through them okay with the support of my colleagues, and I then, with the military, worked in the Far East and in Germany and so on, in military hospitals. But I was lucky. My parents were both, or my father at least, was a musician, and so I inherited that sort of the desire to perform from him, and that expressed itself in various ways. But I finished up writing, taking further courses and so on, and went into education and teaching, where one is always performing. From there, the writing was really what became the key to what I did after that, because once you start to write and your name begins to be mentioned, you're invited to speak in other places and take on other responsibilities. So it just really grew like Topsy, and as an example, over this next couple of months, I'm on a lecture tour in America. I have to give a talk in Bratislava. I have another one to give in Stockholm. And last year was New Zealand and America again and so on. And so after a while, when you write, in particular when you put pen to paper and you're prepared to back up what you say, there is a lot of opportunities. But for me, probably the major point was being employed as a research fellow in Oxford and working at the National Institute for Nursing as head of the mental health. And that led to the job with the RCN, which opened so many doors. And the politician bit is a small p, but I gave evidence to the Standing Committee of Mental Health at the House of Parliament, and was a regular appearer on the BBC radio program. So it expanded me, it challenged me. And I think that if I had to say one thing about being a psychiatric nurse, it teaches you to be confident and to believe you can do things. And the more you do, of course, the more you get offered.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqat tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.